American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life.
We are now part of the Queen City Podcast Network.
That's awesome.
We're part of a network.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
And I am Mookie Wilson's friend.
All right, that's Joe.
Peter McElroy.
All right, that's Joe.
I met Mookie Wilson on an airplane.
Okay.
Back in the 70s.
And this is...
Okay, my name is Joe. That was a ruse.
This is the podcast that brings you nostalgic, interesting, and crazy events in American pop culture history, year by year.
Year by year.
And it's episode one of season three.
This is our new season, y'all. We made it through the 90s, then we made it to the 80s, then...
And it's just going to get crazier. This is the 1970s.
Now we're going to embark on the 70s. You know what the 70s were.
70s were crazy.
But the crazy, funky colors of the 60s were leaving out, and people didn't know what to do next. I think that's why the 70s were crazy and brown and orange and...
Well, and I was looking at a lot of images from the 70s to prepare for this. And it, even like if you look up images from the 1970s, a lot of recipes, pictures of recipes, like finished.
Yeah.
Like, and they all contain Jell-O. Every one of them.
Everything
it's like
has
they
Jell-O
would even
in it.
Put like gazpacho in Jell-O and like salty foods for some reason. And then the other thing was they loved putting googly eyes on everything.
Googly
like,
eyes
there
were a
googly
big thing.
Eyes on everything.
Yeah, we did have googly eyes. I mean, it was like a new invention. It was like everything was space.
I guess. I don't know if googly eyes were a new invention, but they loved sticking them on shit.
Yeah, the beginning of 1970, I don't know what it was like. I can't imagine because I was not alive.
Nope, neither was
but
I.
But disco didn't start till the 70s, right?
Right.
So I always kind of confuse that with the 60s and the 70s.
You had disco confused in the 60s?
Well, I thought it started in the late 60s, but I guess
disco?
Was,
no, yeah. Late 70s.
Oh, late 70s.
Huh? Yeah, disco went into the 80s, early 80s.
No.
Yep, it did.
Really?
Well, disco didn't die until like 80, maybe 81
yeah,
or 82.
Yeah, I guess that's, well, we'll see. We'll see what you say after this podcast episode, because I got a little disco research, baby.
Sweet.
Disco fever, so that's the 70s. That's all 70s.
Yes, it is. And so, start us off at the beginning of the year,
well,
babe.
There's a few things, as a lot. As I'm wont to do.
Yes.
There are a bunch of little just tidbits and things that don't really have dates to them.
Right.
That I like to just bring up at the beginning of an episode.
Like, what
and,
do you got?
And right here at the start of season three of American Timelines.
Mm-hmm.
This is a throwback to one of our previous episodes. I think it was the 1997 episode in season one. It was something I mentioned that goes from 1970 to 1997. We'll see if you remember.
Okay.
Elton, a young man named Elton John.
Oh, he number one hit every year.
He charted a top 40 single every year.
That's right.
Starting this year, 1970.
All the way.
Episode one of season three. All the way to episode
whatever it was.
Seven of season one, 1997.
Wow.
1970 to 1997, a top 40 single every single year, Elton John. That's a bad motherfucker.
And what was this top 40?
Okay, the first one was Your Song.
Oh, and I would tell everybody, this is your song. I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words.
Well, just so you know.
I love that song.
Also, Crazy Glue was introduced in 1970.
Oh, you're kidding.
Although the main ingredient, cyanocrylate, was discovered in 1942 by Harry Coover while working for Kodak, Crazy Glue wasn't actually introduced until 1970.
Wow.
Isn't that funny?
That's good.
The Boeing's Jumbo Jet debuted.
Now, is Crazy Glue the one that the commercial where the guy's hanging by a hard hat with a brick? You know that commercial?
I don't know.
Was it Crazy Glue or Super Glue?
I don't know.
I think that was Crazy Glue. Do you remember that commercial?
Nope.
He's got, it's like some guy in a wife beater and he's got a hard hat.
Wife beater
and
is
on top
not
of the hat.
Wife beater is not acceptable nomenclature in the Me Too movement.
All right. And above that is a brick, and then he's hanging on a beam by the brick from that's on his hat. And
it sounds a little familiar, but I don't know if it's worth discussing.
Well, some people are going to be like, yeah, I totally remember that commercial. Just because you don't think it's worth it. Listen to all the bullshit that I had to sit through for the entire 1980s with wrestling and the stuff that I could give a shit less about.
Dear American Timelines listeners, please tweet us at History for Jerks and let us know.
If you remember that commercial.
That story? And do you remember it? And if you do, are you happy Amy went on and on and on about it for 25
minutes? I was just trying to describe
it. Now, that's a pretty good description. Also, Boeing's Jumbo Jet, the 747, debuted in 1970.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Isn't that pretty good?
I know, like, commercial. I think I remember that the Jumbo Jet being a big deal because so many more people could travel, and it went so much further. Like, it could go further away.
So you remember when they came out?
I don't remember that. I remember knowing that happened in the 70s.
That happened in the 70s. There was so much more. Yeah, it must have been. Well, you know, you used to be able to smoke cigarettes on planes.
Yeah, that's true.
Samsung originally sold noodles, just so you know.
Samsung?
Samsung was a noodle sales company, only sold noodles. It wasn't until 1970 that they started selling electronics.
That's weird.
It was a noodle shop. Samsung Noodle Company. And now they make my phone.
Yeah.
One other thing that happened in 1970, but I looked and I just couldn't find the exact date.
Okay.
Orville Redenbacher
was born.
He paid an advertising company $13,000 to come up with a name for his popcorn company.
Oh, and they decided.
Originally, it was called Red Bow because it was Orville Redenbacher and his buddy, whose last name was Bowman or something. Mm-hmm. And they were called Red Bow. They're like, yeah, that's stupid. Mm-hmm. We need something more catchy. What should we do? And they paid some advertising company $13,000 to come up with something. And they said, yeah, just use your fucking name.
Really?
And so we went with Orville Redenbacher, his actual name. And
everybody knew how to pronounce it for some reason right away.
It took the world by storm. Because I think all of his commercials were like, I'm Orville Redenbacher.
Yep.
I think everybody stopped and was like, who the hell is this guy? Why is he saying his name? And so they were right. And I guess they made their $13,000 back in popcorn.
Yep.
Now, when we start the year, January 1st, 1970, we started the year with the number one song, Leftover from 1969, which we will end our fourth season talking about, probably.
That's right.
Diana Ross had the number one song to go in the new year from December 27, 1969, all the way to January 2nd, 1970. Diana Ross and the Supremes, Someday We'll Be Together.
Someday we'll be together. Yes, we will. Yes, we will.
Someday.
It's going to be amazing to me the difference in the quality of music from the 80s going down to the 70s.
Yeah, I've noticed that just doing the research. I'm like, these are
all going to be really good songs.
Yeah. Although it was released as the final Supreme song featuring Diana Ross,
mm-hmm.
who left the group for a solo career in January of 1970, it was recorded as Ross's first solo single. And Supremes members Mary Wilson and Cindy Birdsong do not sing on the recording.
Oh, they don't.
But they both appear on the B-side. He's My Sunny Boy.
Yeah, I don't know that one.
You know that one? Mm-hmm. But this is the whole thing, too. This is the B-sides.
Yeah.
Those have gone away. Yeah, like, we don't have those anymore. If you talk to younger people, they don't know what's a B-side.
What's a B-side? They don't even know what a 45 is.
Yeah, so I guess now, sometimes folks still put out EPs. And there's a B-side would be the secondary songs on those, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
But when you look at the Billboard list of top songs, if you look at 1970... It's always two songs. It's always the whatever it is,
and then the B-side
the
song.
Hit and then the B-side. Because they automatically were listed.
So let's explain quickly what it is for people that don't know.
B-side was? Well, any music you bought, if you bought a single, it was on our little tiny record.
Yep, called a 45.
A 45, just a smaller version of a big record. They're not called records. What are they called? Vinyls? Vinyls that...
We called them records.
Yeah, the young kids say just that's what... music nerds like as records. They collect vinyls.
Yeah.
But that was all you could buy then.
Yep. There was no tapes.
There was 8-tracks maybe? When did 8-tracks start?
In the 70s, but I don't think yet.
Yeah. Anyway, 8-tracks, still don't get an 8-track.
No, weird. That's so dumb.
But so you bought a little record, and why would you not put something on the other side of the record? You can flip it. And so I imagine a lot of bands and artists had to really think about, well, what's our B-side going to be?
Yeah. Well, and so the A-side was the hit.
It was always the hit. It was always the song they're releasing. That's right.
And then the B-side, the other flipped over the record, you'll see, and it was usually a crap song.
Anyway, Diana Ross reunited with Wilson and Birdsong in 1983. Did you know that? Performing the single for the Motown 25, no. Yesterday, Today, Forever television special. That's the one where Michael Jackson did his Unleashed.
Oh, iconic moonwalk.
Unleashed his moonwalk on the world.
Yeah.
But that performance was marred by lingering hostility between Ross and Wilson, which Motown insiders report resulted in Ross shoving Wilson out of her way during the onstage performance.
Ooh, boom.
Isn't that cool?
Diana Ross is the diva and a half, I bet.
Oh, God.
I bet she's... Oh, she's well,
I have,
theater.
I have seen her writer.
Yeah.
this is the one when anybody asks, what's the craziest writer you ever saw? I always bring up hers because there was actually a stipulation in it that stated that she she refused to be in any rooms that weren't white.
Yeah.
Like, at all times, she had to be surrounded by white backgrounds.
Yeah.
So, it's not just the green room had to have white walls. Like, she had to have white.
So, what did you put? White sheets on everything?
Yeah, we hung pipe and drape, white pipe and drape all the way from this green room to the stage.
So weird.
So she could be surrounded in white, draped in white. But when you're her, somebody like that, you can do what you want.
Yeah, you can. Yep.
But I'll never forget. Oh, no, I thought it was her, but I think it was Natalie Cole wanted like 8 boxes of cereal, and they had to be a certain size box. And then she never opened any of them and left them all.
What?
So we had to buy all the cereal and then just give it to stagehands. That's cool.
How come you never bring any of that shit home?
No, sometimes I don't find out about it till later. There's a lot of more needy people than me, babe.
I know.
I'm not the only person that gets to take everything. Okay. And then also on January 1st, 1970, the movie MASH was released.
Yes. So, it was a movie before it was a show.
The movie MASH, yes, which is before the show. Didn't come out till 72, I believe, which I've started watching on Hulu because of our podcast and that episode that the finale of MASH was the most watched episode any television show
and
in history.
All the sewers backed up. And
Yeah, everybody pooped. As soon as it was over, everybody pooped.
So weird. What a weird phenomenon.
Everyone held their poop during MASH because that's when everyone poops, apparently.
Yep.
So everybody pooped at once when MASH was over. So that just made me say, I got to know what the hubbub's about.
Yeah.
I got to watch all 9 seasons or whatever it is of God. MASH. It's going to take some time. I mean, went into the 80s. If it started in 72, went through the 80s. Wow. So.
Yeah, you'd have to watch MASH pretty much straight for about a year.
I can't say I'm going to watch every episode.
The entire catalog.
Really, I'm really finding it's really misogynistic. Like,
yes.
Really misogynistic.
Yes.
We're in the Me Too movement now, so I'm sure everything you look back on is.
But it's really bad.
But basically, it's about the two alcoholic doctors who can do whatever they want.
Sexually harass everybody.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want because they're doctors. Nobody else, they need them so bad that they can't find the doctors.
It's abuse of power.
They can just do whatever they want and say whatever they want and grab whoever they want, and they really just treat the ladies like they're pieces of meat and get drunk in the morning.
Yeah, that's pretty much...
But the movie I have not seen, so part of me feels like, should I watch the movie first and then
it's
going to
be probably similar.
Yeah, it'll be similar.
I think the...
Except Elliot Gould is the lead in the movie, and I don't know. Maybe it's just not being somebody who wasn't born until 76, but Elliot Gould doesn't...
he's not sex symbol material.
He doesn't strike me as a successful actor.
Yeah.
But I think people much older than us, the generation...
Would say,
they think, oh, Elliot Gould, he's the shit.
Yeah, that's right.
I've always thought he's the fat, curly-haired guy from Saturday Night Live, and...
He was in Saturday Night Live?
Well, he hosted a lot. He was in the Five Timers Club.
When he was.
The Frequent Hosters Club, and he was just in different sitcoms and stuff all the time, like... he's like Bruce Valanche to me.
But
other people would be shocked and slap my face. Anyway.
Oh, God. Elliot Gould.
So now we're talking about, in this episode, I want to say that we're going to talk about these movies from 1970. And Amy and I sat down and we thought, let's do a little research. Let's maybe watch a couple of these. But we're also very cheap. So we decided not to pay for any. So if we could find any for free, we'll watch them.
Yep.
And we only found one for free and we're still not done with it. But we did what we did do. Our dedication comes through in the fact that we watched all the trailers for these movies. So we watched the MASH trailer. And so those of you that have seen MASH, here are some tidbits. The first take of the shot where Hot Lips is revealed in the shower didn't work mm-hmm. because Sally Kellerman anticipated the reveal and was already lying on the floor when the tent flap went up. But to distract her, Robert Altman, the director, and Gary Berghoff, who plays Radar, he's a little guy, he's mm-hmm. only one of the only people that's in both the show and the movie.
Yeah.
He entered the shower tent and dropped his trousers while the shot was rolling outside. And while Kellerman was staring at them, the tent flap was raised, resulting in her genuine surprise and shock when she realized what had happened.
So he's sunning her?
Yeah, I guess. He showed us nuts. Sunning. Is that when you just drop your front?
Yeah.
You show your front? That's called. Yeah. Is that called that?
I think.
Or did you just make that up?
No, I think that's what it's called. That's what we used to call it.
Mooning. Is like, put your butt out. I've never heard the term sunning.
Oh, you haven't?
But apparently Gary Berghoff showed her his junk in order to get her to be surprised and shocked. Look at this wiener.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, he's standing naked beside the. That's so funny. So you see her surprise in that movie. If you go back and watch that movie,
he's staring at his dick.
Yeah, picture Gary Berghoff's penis. Tom Skerritt recalled that the dialogue was about 80% improvised in this movie. In order to create a different kind of atmosphere, Robert Altman cast some of the parts from improv clubs who had no previous movie experience.
Oh, that's pretty sweet.
It's pretty smart.
So how much of it is improv?
80%.
Oh, wow.
According to Robert Altman, this was the first R-rated movie to use the word fuck in it. But apparently it wasn't his idea. During second unit shooting for the football game that comes near the end of the film, John Shuck was told to say something really nasty to his opponent. Mm-hmm. Shuck came up with, "All right, bub, your fucking head is coming right off." And it made it into the film's final cut.
Wow, it's the first time they said fuck?
The first fuck in an R-rated movie.
Really?
So that leads me to believe there were X-rated movies that had fuck in it.
Yes, well, I guess. I wonder when the first X-rated movie was, but we'll probably find out.
I did read doing some research, and I don't know if I wrote it down, so I might not bring it up, but so I'll bring it up now. There were movies that were rated X. There's a lot more X-rated movies.
But they weren't sexual.
Yeah, they weren't dirty sex movies. They just had some bad words in them because people were more prudish than
yeah.
That later they changed the ratings. Like some okay. got downgraded to R.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
So there probably were. It probably used to be, and if there's an F word in it, it's X mm-hmm. immediately.
Yeah. You
know, so I don't know how many had F in it, but it's interesting. Maybe we should take a film class.
We'll know more. All our spare time.
Yeah. And then January 3rd of 1970 was when Diana Ross and the Supremes lost their last number one single to be on the chart together as the Supremes.
Mm-hmm.
It was not number one anymore because BJ Thomas came by and said, "Yo, motherfuckers, I'm about to drop some motherfucking raindrops on my motherfucking head."
That's a good song.
You know that song?
Raindrops are falling on my head.
That does mean
to soon be turning red. I wonder if Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was, that song is from that movie.
Yeah, so that's funny. I did not know that. I was going to drop that knowledge on you. I looked that up. Did you know? I can't believe this is that.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that, huh?
Yeah, there's a scene where he's riding in the bike with his girlfriend. Have you ever seen the movie? It's a really good movie.
A bike? Isn't it a Western?
Yeah, it's like they're just in a little yard, and it's like a montage of them being lovers, and they're like riding a bike together and stuff.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are lovers?
No, it was Sundance Kid's girlfriend.
It was Robert Redford. Was
yeah, but, right? He was a Sundance Kid.
Who was Butch Cassidy?
Paul Newman.
Oh, I think I'm mixing this up with something else. I was thinking it was John Wayne. Who was John Wayne? He was in it?
No, John no. Wayne was probably dead.
What am I thinking of, Butch?
I don't know what you're thinking of. This one's a really good movie, though. You should watch it.
I think I had to watch this, and I did take a film class in
college. You probably slept through it or something.
Well, I was high a lot in college. Like, I really enjoyed marijuana and the way it makes you feel in college.
So you went to school high a lot?
Well, I think I went to school normal, and then I'd see somebody I know.
Oh.
And he'd say, "Hey, you want to smoke a J in this breezeway?" And I'd be like, "Well, of course."
Yes.
But I didn't. A lot of times I didn't think of the concept. I didn't think, "Oh, well, I should have said, I'm going to class. That's not a good idea.
But now right.
I need to pay attention." But instead, I was like, "Yes, I will take every opportunity to smoke a joint." Anyway, and that song was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Burt Bacharach was a big fucking deal in the 1970s.
Oh yeah,
you know. So it won an Academy Award, like you said, you knew it was from that.
Yeah.
But they poor BJ Thomas.
Yeah.
Now I think BJ Thomas recorded. We're gonna have to look this up. This might be a correction apology. I'm gonna go ahead and say it. I believe BJ Thomas was the original singer of the Golden Girls theme song.
What?
Thank you for being a fan. There's a different version, the original song.
The one where he goes, oh, yeah.
No, that's the gospel guy. That's on that, YouTube. Which is great. If you look on YouTube and just look up gospel version of Golden Girls.
Oh, my God. It's hysterical.
That might be the greatest thing ever. That was my ringtone for probably like 3 different years of my life.
It is
so good.
So good.
It's my paw right here. It's great. You really have to look at it. Stop what you're doing right now. Look at that.
It's so funny.
It's great. But anyway, but I think BJ Thomas sings that. Anyway.
There's a woman sings that.
No, for the TV show, but the original is a guy. No, it's Andrew Gold. Never mind. Sorry.
All right. Whole thing.
I just remember that. Point. So I don't have to do a correction apology because I remembered Andrew Gold sounds just like BJ Thomas to me.
Okay.
Anyway, BJ Thomas, I do think, though, again, another possible correction apology. I think he did sing some sitcom theme songs, like Growing Pains or something. There's some of them out there, I think. I could be wrong.
I don't know where you're thinking that.
There's at least one TV sitcom that he sang, if not 7.
I have no idea where you're getting at.
But speaking of number 7, Burt Bacharach said, yo, I don't like this recording. Please record it again to BJ Thomas 6 times.
Oh,
he had re-recorded 7 times. So that was Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. It's a good song.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings back tons of memories for me being a kid. I remember hearing that on the radio. My mom, I think, would sing it anytime it rained.
Yeah.
And Monday, January 5th, 1970, just 2 days after that, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head became the number 1 song.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Lucy was on television, and it was the top, it was the 3rd most popular television show.
Here's Lucy.
Here's Lucy. Starring Lucille Ball as Lucy Carlton, a widow with 2 teen children.
Really?
Who takes a job as a secretary for her stuffy brother-in-law.
I didn't know that she did that.
Yeah.
I wonder how long that was on for.
I should have written that down, but it was a couple of years, I think. And
yeah.
I had no idea either that she was on a sitcom where she was, it was like it's just called Here's Lucy. And on this particular episode, you know, Lucy's got star power, so she probably always had special guests. But Craig's high school club initiation scavenger hunt includes a candelabra that Craig borrowed from Liberace. Lucy, of course, thinks it's been stolen, feels obliged to return it to the famous pianist. A cute song and dance segment follows as the whole family ends up with Liberace at his home.
Oh.
Liberace guest starred on that sitcom.
On the sitcom. Isn't that something?
I feel like Liberace was on a lot of television in the 70s.
I think he's been on soap operas and stuff.
And you know what? I think
in the 80s he was on some soap operas.
I think he might also have been gay.
Maybe.
I'm not sure.
It's an idea. Getting some far out ideas.
My gaydar is starting to go off whenever I see Liberace.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, January 11th, 1970, it was the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
The Super Bowl happened, and I didn't write what the Super Bowl was. Super Bowl number, whatever. But anyway, the Minnesota Vikings were in the Super Bowl.
That was the last time they were in, isn't it?
No. No, they were in 4 in the 70s.
Okay. Don't get feisty now.
No, that might not be true. They might have had one in the 60s. They've been in 4.
Mm-hmm.
But they got their asses beat, even though they were heavily favored.
Okay.
The Chiefs beat the Vikings 23-7.
That's how they always lose, like that.
Yeah, when everybody thinks they're going to win, and it's a dominant.
Every time, still does that.
Yeah, they still do that. But I wasn't born yet, so it's not my fault. The Vikings were favored by 12.5. Oh, this is Super Bowl 4. I did write it down. So, yeah, they were all in the 70s, and I think this is the first Super Bowl they were in. Super Bowl 4.
Super Bowl 4?
4.
So, I thought the Super Bowl has been around for a lot longer than that.
No, it started in the late 60s, but before that, there were NFL championships.
Oh.
But they weren't called the Super Bowl until the AFL and the NFL merged.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And now there's the AFC and the NFC, but they're all part of the NFL. But anyway.
Yeah.
Super Bowl 4 is also notable for NFL films miking up the Kansas City Chiefs head coach Hank Stram during the game. It's the first time a head coach wore a microphone during the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they never did that before.
So he's probably cussing and...
Oh, there's tons of... He talks like this. I'm Hank Stram.
Oh,
Hank
my
Stram.
God.
Yeah, why you gonna do that? And he's wearing a suit, you know, on the sideline like the old days in the mm-hmm. like 60s type stuff. So that was memorable. Len Dawson was the MVP.
Now, why is it... Why is it
the quarterback for the Chiefs?
Coaches wife. That... How come coaches in football don't wear uniforms, but baseball coaches wear uniforms?
I don't know. I don't know. I've always wondered that, but I'm going to take a guess.
Okay.
You know how we talked about in the end of the 80s that Pete Rose, who was gambling,
yeah.
was a player manager?
Oh, so sometimes they play?
Yeah, I think they played, maybe.
Why do they still wear
Maybe there was more often player managers in the younger, and now they still, I don't know why they still do.
Is it so dumb looking?
Maybe they're always like an emergency player. Like yeah, something. Like maybe still are. Maybe these old guys will get off and play if they ran out of players.
It's probably something we could look up and find the answer to really easily, but I've just always wondered it.
Probably isn't a good manager. Like think how ridiculous it would be in other sports. Like
I know.
What if in the NBA they wore
same outfit as the players?
A tank top. Or what if in hockey they wore a helmet and a, you know.
Even the football playing would look weird and stupid.
Yeah, with a helmet
big
on.
Big giant pads and stuff.
Pads. Yeah, it is pretty stupid.
So dumb.
I don't know. It's stupid. It's probably because they're comfortable. Like in baseball, those are uniforms.
It's like unitard.
Well, no, they're different. I know.
There's just two pieces, but it looks
the same
like,
color sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm sure they don't wear a jock strap because jock straps aren't comfy.
So why do they wear the rest of it? If you're going to wear it, you got to wear the whole thing.
Do you know that this is speaking of somebody who's worn both a jock strap and a dance belt?
Yes.
They're basically the same thing.
Yeah.
The only difference is jock strap has a slot for a cup.
Oh, right.
Which I couldn't wear. I couldn't run with it. The cup was too big. Covered my junk, baby.
It was too big?
Yeah.
Or too small?
Hey.
Wouldn't you want the cup to be too small?
No, because you want it to cover everything so you don't get hit in the nuts, but then you can't run if it's too big on your legs.
Oh.
Like it wasn't form-fitting. It was weird. I don't know. It's like wearing a codpiece. How can you run with a codpiece?
Yeah.
But then if you don't wear it, then you hit the nuts and your life is over.
I'm just picturing dicks and balls right now in my head.
I know. You love dicks and balls. Well, nine days out of ten, you're picturing dicks and balls. Like when I see you on the street walking around.
I'd rather not be.
Doom-de-doom-de-doom. I can tell you're picturing balls and dicks.
Nope.
Okay. You need to now. You have some guessing to do. We're in the Super Bowl, young lady. So you have national anthem singer to guess and a cost of a Super Bowl ad to guess.
Cost of a Super Bowl ad, I'm never going
to
get.
You have a halftime show to guess.
I bet the cost of a Super Bowl ad was a lot lower.
Well, you figure.
I just mean even than you would think. I bet it was probably like
if you had to guess, 1970 television.
Like $10,000 or something.
That's pretty low.
Yeah.
Don't be an idiot now.
Well.
just kidding. I don't know how you would even guess.
No.
$78,000.
Okay.
Pretty low, but not as low as you think.
It's expensive, I would say, for 1970.
For 1970, 78 grand. I mean, you'd be like, oh, 78 grand, gee.
Yeah.
What, are you going to buy a Super Bowl ad with that?
They said the average worker only made like 9,000 something a year.
Oh, yeah, probably $10,000. I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that was what it was.
You imagine?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Just a different world. Inflation's a crazy thing.
It is crazy.
And do you want to take a stab at the Super Bowl national anthem singer?
Was it a man or a woman?
There's two fellas, and I don't think you might get one of them if I drop this hint.
All right.
He was a late night musician, one of the late night bands, one of the late night talk show bands.
Oh, leaders. God. I don't know.
He was Johnny Carson's band leader.
Oh, God. Now that's on the tip of my tongue.
And he looked just like my stepdad when he had a mustache.
What's it? Who is it?
It rhymes with Fock Severinsen.
Oh, Doc Severinsen.
Yeah. Doc Severinsen and Pat O'Brien sang the national anthem.
I don't know who Pat O'Brien is.
I don't either. I thought maybe you did.
No.
And the halftime show was the Battle of New Orleans. Tribute.
Oh, tribute.
Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows
that remember,
even means?
Way before they even did like, real
the
bands.
Pop stars. Can we pause for like 5 seconds? I have to get
Can you imagine, though, in the 70s, though, if they had, like, if you time travel back to the 70s, you'd be like, hey, Super Bowl people. Why not have a kick-ass band?
Right.
Think of all the money you'll make. Have a kick-ass band, you know? Have a fucking Beatles. Have the Beatles. They're about to break up. And the Supremes are about to break up. Just have them perform. Saturday, January 31st, 1970, the Jackson 5.
Oh.
Reached the top of the Billboard chart, and they push the raindrop on my head guy.
Yep.
BJ Novak.
Whatever his name was.
BJ Thomas.
Yeah.
Blowjob Thomas. They push Blowjob right off, and they take over with a lesser known. Nope, a lesser known. That's later in the year.
Okay.
Jackson 5 were all over the 1970, by the way. This one, I Want You Back.
I don't know.
The bass line of this song is considered by many as the greatest bass line of all time.
Really?
And although Gladys Knight had been the first to mention the Jacksons to Berry Gordy and Bobby Taylor, Motown credited Diana Ross with discovering them. And this was done not only to promote the Jackson 5, but also to help ease Ross's transition into a solo career, which she began in 1970, soon after the Jackson 5 became a success.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah,
poor Gladys Knight.
Yeah, poor Gladys Knight and the pimps. But I Want You Back, you would definitely know that. I Want You Back.
I Want You Back.
I Want You Back. No, it's totally, you totally right. I have it in my head, but I can't.
Oh, yeah.
That's the bass
line. Yeah.
Oh, baby, give me one more chance to show you that I love you. Won't you please let me back in your heart? Terry Gordy, Terry Gordy was a wrestler in the...
okay.
In the...
You're just trying to slip in wrestling in the 1970 episode.
I got
to
slip in wrestling where I can because it's not Berry Gordy. There was some concern, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but there was concern about some of these lyrics are like pretty adult, and we're having these children singing about wanting to bang these chicks.
Yeah.
It's a little bit not cool.
It's true if you think about it.
Yeah, if you do think about it.
It's kind of creepy.
It is creepy, but at the same time, it's fucking good.
Yeah.
Jackson 5 is great.
Yeah.
I love it. Like, I mean, their songs are really, really, really good.
Yeah.
And just like you said, we're talking about the 70s are so much better than the 80s. 80s was garbage.
Yes, it was.
Let's just say it. 80s is garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, Jackson 5 is the fucking shit.
Yeah, a lot of them are going to be.
And so I'm not saying I condone Joe Jackson
beating
chemically. Chemically castrating Michael to keep that voice.
Yeah.
But you really kind of understand. He's so good. It's gold. You have gold in your hands. And you just... But, oh no, it's going to go away. His voice is going to change. We can't let that happen. We have gold right here.
That's
like
right.
Liquid gold. It's so good. So, anyone who has child stars, I recommend chemically castrating.
No. All right.
I don't even know what chemically castrating somebody is. February 7th, 1970, Shocking Blue knocks the Jackson 5 off the top of the Billboard charts with Venus.
Okay.
I'm your Venus. I'm your Venus. So
that was the original.
That was the original.
That's right.
And it's good. And it's on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. That's the original.
The original is on the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes,
good.
It is. And it's better than the Bananarama version. Although the Bananarama version had its own merits. This one was better.
Yes.
But the this somebody, when they wrote the lyrics, they miswrote the line, "The goddess of the mountaintop," and this singer originally sang it as "the godness of the mountaintop."
What?
In the original.
It doesn't even make sense.
The godness. Well, somebody just misspelled it.
So yeah.
She's sang it that way. But then
it was a he, I think.
No. Mariska Veras.
Oh, okay.
It's a lady. Later, they corrected it. I'm your Venus. I'm your flame. And then on February 14th, 1970... Sly and the Family Stone hit the top of the Billboard charts.
Oh, yeah.
You know what song?
I don't know.
I Wanna Thank You
for letting me be myself.
I Wanna Thank You for letting me be Mice Elf.
No.
Mice Elf.
No.
That's how it's spelled. Have you ever seen that?
No, no. All right, we're moving on.
No. This isn't a joke. I'm telling you. If you look up the title of that song, it's called Thank You, in parentheses.
For letting me be myself.
No, for letting me. F-A-L-E-T-T-I-N-M-E is one word. For letting me. B, mice, M-I-C-E. Elf, E-L-F.
Where did you see that?
H-E-I-N. Everywhere. You didn't know that? Thank you for letting me be myself.
No, you're making it up.
I'm not.
Why would it be that?
The title is an intentional Mundagreen, or sensational spelling for thank you for letting me be myself again.
Oh.
And the third verse contains special references to the group's previous successful songs, Dance to the Music, Everyday People, Sing a Simple Song, and You Can Make It If You Try. I really like Sly and the Stone, Family mm-hmm. Stone. Everyday People, it's like,
I'll, yeah.
If that comes on the radio, on my phone or mm-hmm. my whatever, I play it again every yeah. time. And Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself.
Mm-hmm.
Always play it again. It's so great.
Yeah.
I can't believe you didn't know that. I can't believe no. I dropped knowledge you on you about you, Sly and the Family Stone.
You did. I didn't know that they did that.
And you believe me? You totally believe what I just said? No. You believed it as soon as I said that word. I didn't know what it meant.
Yes.
That's how you knew
it. That's the only reason I was like, wait a minute, what? A sensational spelling.
Yeah. Yeah. They really did that. So.
All right.
Yeah. I could have sworn you knew that. Anyway.
Nope.
Sly and the Family Stone are great. And then Monday, February 16th, 1970, Gunsmoke was on TV.
Yes. I remember Gunsmoke.
And that was like the number two.
Was it really?
Or number one. I think it was the number one. It was one of the top television shows of the year. No, it was number two behind.
But remember, America's Well-Being. That's out of five channels. So
that's true.
The number one shows are not always going to be really quality programming.
Well, that same night that Gunsmoke was on CBS, Laugh-In was on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And the guests on Laugh-In that night were Dan Blocker from Bonanza,
mm-hmm.
Johnny Brown, Perry Como, Tom Smothers, and Flip Wilson. And it's also the same day that Joe Frazier knocked out Jimmy Ellis in five rounds for the Undisputed Heavyweight Boxing Crown. And I believe that you have some info for Monday, February 16th, 1970, don't you?
I do. I am going to preface it, though, a little bit, like sometimes I do.
Wait. Sometimes you preface things?
Yeah. I'm going to preface it with a little bit of some earlier stuff.
Okay.
I am going to... My story in for 1970 is the case of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald.
Okay. You ever heard? No, I don't know what this is.
Okay. So
I'm assuming it's somebody who probably murdered a bunch of people and raped a bunch of animals.
All right.
Knowing you.
So... Jeffrey McDonald was born in Queens, New York, and raised on Long Island.
I've actually been to Queens, New York.
Okay. And he was voted most popular and most likely to succeed in high school.
Uh-oh.
He was senior class president and captain of the football team.
Oh, that sounds like me.
He won a scholarship to Princeton, and then he had a relationship with Colette Stevenson in high school, and they resumed their relationship.
Now, I've never seen this Colette Stevenson person. Yeah. I haven't seen pictures. I've never heard of this person, but that she sounds hot.
Yeah, well, she was beautiful.
She was?
Okay.
Did he murder her?
Then on... Will you just let me get She's to the story?
He's going to murder her, isn't he?
So on September 14th, 63, they got married, and then they had...
63? We're not in the 60s, honey.
No, I know. We had daughter Kimberly, and was born in April 18th, 1964. Then they moved to Chicago, and so he could go to medical school. And
they
then,
moved to Chicago from...
Queens, New York.
Queens, New York.
Yeah, and then
to
they
go to medical school.
Well, no, he was at Princeton. Yeah, and probably from Queens, New York. And then they had another child, Kristen. She was born in 1967.
That's a nice name. Hopefully, she doesn't end up murdered.
Then he joined the U.S. Army on July 1st, 1969, and they moved to Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Oh, Fort Bragg, not far from where we are here recording live.
That's right.
From our home studio in Charlotte, North Carolina.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
He held the rank of captain, and he was an army surgeon.
Army surgeon?
Yep.
So, basically, he's Hawkeye from MASH.
Yep,
which we're just talking about.
It could be. So, on...
What's the guy's name again?
Jeffrey McDonald.
Jeffrey McDonald. So, he's a honky?
Yeah.
White guy?
Yeah.
Is
I guess...
Is honky the preferred nomenclature?
Yeah, you used that word twice now.
You're
so,
honky.
On February 17th at 3:45 a.m.
Oh, just a couple hours before that girl starting Marlo Thomas was on at
so,
11.
Dispatchers received a call from McDonald, who has said
dispatchers
at 911 or the police. They didn't. I don't think they had 911 yet. So the police.
Oh, when was 911 invented?
I don't think it wasn't invented until we'll probably get to it in the '70s. I think they receive a call from McDonald, who says that people have been stabbed.
He himself called.
Yes.
And says that just people have been stabbed. And this is in Chicago or in Fort Bragg.
At Fort Bragg, yeah, at his home. So his then home. Some MPs arrive at 544 Castle Drive and find the front.
That's military police to you,
yep.
Idiots.
To find the front door closed and locked and the house dark.
Oh, the house is dark.
They knock and no one answers, so they go to the back door The screen is closed and unlocked, and the back door is wide open.
So,
upon entering, they find...
What did they find?
They find a 5.5-year-old Kimberly dead in her bed.
Oh, why do you have to kill children?
She was clubbed in the head and stabbed in the neck 8 to 10 times.
8 to 10 times.
Then in the next room, they find 2-year-old Kristen dead, stabbed 33 times with a knife and 15 times with an ice pick.
Now, I just said, hopefully these people don't die.
Then in the third bedroom, Colette, who was pregnant, was lying on the floor of the bedroom. She had been repeatedly clubbed. Both her arms were broken. And she was stabbed 21 times with an ice pick and 16 times with a knife.
21 times. That is... Now, I've watched a lot of Forensic Files.
Yeah.
That shows that it's somebody who knows the person because they are very upset. Somebody who doesn't know someone, you don't just kill them a couple. You just stab them a few times.
You
don't do 21 times repeatedly. It's, they hate the person.
So, next to... a man's pajama shirt is draped over her body.
Oh.
Over top of her body.
The wife's?
The wife's, yeah.
Oh.
Then on the headboard, in blood, the word pig was written.
On the headboard, the word pig.
Was written in Colette's blood.
Because she was in the bedroom.
Yeah, she was in her bedroom. So Dr. McDonald is next to her. He's alive, but he's severely wounded.
Oh.
So.
Wait a minute.
But his wounds were not as severe or numerous as the rest of the family.
So he basically has a couple slivers.
Yes.
Maybe a couple cuts and scratches. Maybe like...
Well, one of his lungs was punctured.
Well...
From a stab wound.
Well, probably from fighting all of his family, right?
Could be. So anyway, he suffered cuts and bruises to his face and chest along with a mild concussion. And the stab wound in his torso had also, like I said, caused his left lung to partially collapse. So here's his story. He says that on that night, February 16th, he fell asleep on the couch because his daughter was in bed with the wife. And
the daughter crawled in bed because she was scared of the gun smoke episode that they watched, probably.
So he went in and he saw her and she had wet her side of the bed.
Ugh,
so instead of...
Yeah. I got to say, I'm not sleeping in B. Yeah. I'm with him on this.
So instead of moving her and messing with it, he just went back to the couch to go to sleep.
You know what I would do in that situation? I went up right now and you were asleep and our daughter had peed the bed next to you. I would not only not sleep in that pee, but I would actually add to the pee by peeing on the bed. I would pee on the bed more because it was already established. It's already peeing on the bed.
Right. So I appreciate that.
It's my chance to pee on the bed with no consequence. So I would pee on the bed and then go sleep somewhere else.
You probably would.
Yeah.
So
I would also poop on the bed.
All right. So he says he's awakened later by some screams that he hears. He hears his wife and one of his daughters screaming. So as he rose from the couch, he was attacked by three male intruders.
Three male intruders.
Two white guys and a black guy.
Of course. They always got to throw a black guy in there because of racism.
There's a fourth intruder who's this white female with long blonde hair, high-heeled boots, and a floppy hat on.
And now he's turning into some kind of fantasy.
So she's, they struggle. And during the struggle, his pajama top was pulled over his head and down on his wrists, and he was kind of using the pajama top to ward off the stabs that were coming at him.
I'm starting to believe this.
And he's knocked unconscious. That was the last thing he remembered then. But he did remember that the girl was holding a candle and was chanting, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs."
Okay. "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." So he's making up a cult thing.
Something, right?
If he did it, he's just making up some people. So, but now I'm starting to believe this.
So
it's so bizarre.
The Army CID did not believe his account. Because
CID stands for...
Oh, I didn't look. I can't remember.
Corporal in distress?
Something.
No.
It's like the Army's CID. Investigation.
Like the investigation unit.
Yeah.
I bet we could come up with this.
So
detectives. CI detectives.
So they said the physical evidence didn't match. The one of the things was the living room didn't show it. It had like an overturned coffee table.
Yeah.
And a flower plant was knocked over, and that was about it.
Yeah. So it
and so
like,
it's like, how would there be this staged. Grown men struggling, and that be all that happens? And then the other thing he had said that when he went in and found his wife, he took his pajama top and. This is after he came to.
Right.
So he goes unconscious. When he came to call the police,
yeah,
he said that when he found his wife, he laid his pajama top on her to like cover her up.
Right.
And then he said he went and he found his daughters and then he called 911 and then he passed out. So that's how she got his pajama top on her.
Okay.
So, but they found there was no fibers from the pajama top found at all in the living room, but there was there were several found under Colette's body. And in both of the girls' rooms. And he's, according to his story, he didn't have it on anymore when he went into the girls' rooms.
Gross.
But part of me is like, that fiber evidence, it's like, what is it, like one little skinny thread? I mean, how do they know?
Maybe it was like a, maybe it was like one of those pajama tops that just was fuzzy and yeah. just like shreds everywhere.
I mean, isn't that, don't you wonder about that?
I would
what,
think that
what is that fiber?
Wouldn't that pajama top be everywhere then? The guy probably wore that pajama top
right.
all over the house.
That's the other thing.
But and maybe never went in the living room.
There was also a fiber found under Kristen's fingernails.
Well, that's
more, a little bit
that's
more.
That's more damning evidence.
Yeah.
There.
The murder weapons were both were found outside the back door. It was a knife. They were like under a bush and it was a knife, a piece of lumber, and an ice pick.
Yeah.
And they all three had come from the house. So they weren't foreign objects.
They're all items that were in the house originally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's this dude's motivation? Is he just a crazy guy?
Well, that's what we... Hold on.
All right.
So the word pig had been written with somebody using a surgical glove.
Okay.
And tips of the surgical gloves were found beneath the headboard where the word was written. And they were identical to a supply that McDonald kept in the kitchen.
He already had.
Yes.
You see, that's... They're not going to know that they're there. Like, some weirdos will break in, and even right. though they said those weird things.
So then, with the blood, the family all had... there was a kind of an anomaly, and the family all had different blood types. So
that is definitely an anomaly.
It is. So it
helped... Being a blood type expert.
Well, usually you inherit your blood type from your parents, so it's
okay.
weird that they all had different blood types.
Word.
So that helped the detectives theorize what happened in the house, because they followed the different blood types in the trail. Like, in each room, what blood was there. Because they couldn't DNA. There was no DNA at the time.
So they could, because everyone had different blood types, they could just tell whose blood was where.
Yeah. So
that's crazy. So they're kind of lucky that they all had different.
So they said the fight began in the master bedroom, which turned physical, with Colette probably hit him on the head and caused his concussion. And then he must have retaliated with his fist and the piece of lumber.
As you do.
They said that Kimberly... may have walked in because her blood and brain serum were found in the doorway. So she must have walked in and was hit in the head.
Her brain what?
Brain serum.
What's that?
I don't know. It's probably gush from your head, I guess.
Gush?
Yeah.
Gross.
So they believe that then he...
Why? Let me just ask you this. Let me pause for a second. Why do you like all this?
You why ask do you me that like all this? The time.
Why do you like this? Like, you seem like a normal person to me.
I know.
On the outside, you seem like a...
A lot of people like it.
What's wrong with all of you?
I don't know.
You seem like regular people.
Don't shame us.
But you know, like, you go about your day, you brush your hair. Are you thinking about this stuff when you're brushing your hair?
No.
Like,
all right, listen. Listen. They think that he thought his wife was dead, so then he takes the girl that got hit in the head back into her bedroom, and then he stabs her to make it look like he stabbed her and the other one so in such a frenzy to make it look like it was a crazy attack. So, because their blood was discovered on the pajama top, which McDonald said he wasn't wearing. So her blood, yeah, Kimberly's blood was on the pajama top too. He went to Kristen's room, but before that, Colette, whose blood was found in Kristen's bed covers and wall of her room, must have regained her consciousness and threw herself over Kristen, and then
he
killed them both.
Why don't you just let the baby live? Like, why do you gotta keep killing everybody?
So after killing them both,
if he's gonna call the police eventually,
right?
Just call now.
Yeah,
I'd kill everybody first.
I hear you.
I guess you're just insane, huh?
Well, so after killing them both, he wrapped Colette's body in a sheet and carried it back to the master bedroom, leaving a smudged footprint of her blood on his way out. Then they theorized he attempted to cover up the murders using articles in the Manson family that they found in a magazine in the living room.
What?
There was an article, a Time magazine.
About Charles Manson?
Yeah, that on the cover was the Manson family.
And he used pictures
they're saying
from
he,
that?
No, they're saying he got the idea from that.
Oh, okay.
Then they said he put surgical gloves on, wrote the word pig on the headboard with Colette's blood. Then he laid the torn pajama top over her and stabbed her repeatedly in the chest with the ice pick.
Now, what if this really happened? What if all that really happened? These weirdos broke in and did all this
stuff. I know, that's the thing.
And what if all that really happened? Poor guy, and then he just gets, like, he tried to battle all these weirdos.
Right. So then they say he went, took a scalpel, went to the bathroom, and stabbed himself once. And then he called the ambulance and discarded the weapons. So that's what they think happened.
That's what they think happened. Mm-hmm. So we'll just let you marinate in that horrible murder. While Ironside was the number four most popular television show
Ironside.
In 1970. Ironside, are you familiar with that?
No.
Well, on Thursday, February 26th, 1970, Ironside was on NBC. This starred wheelchair-bound detective Robert T. Ironside battles the bad guys on the streets of San Francisco, starring Raymond Burr, Don Galloway, and Don Mitchell.
So that must have been after Perry Mason, obviously.
I guess
so.
And with his assistance away, the chief receives a phone call telling him to expect a deadly visitor within 60 minutes. Ironside spends the remaining time improvising self-defense without weapons and trying to identify the caller.
Jeez.
So I'm just picturing Raymond Burr sitting in a
chair. In a wheelchair.
You know, this show probably started because Raymond Burr was like, hey, I put on some weight.
I need to sit down.
Yeah, I want to star in your action yeah. thriller where I'm a detective, but can I just be sitting?
I want to sit down.
I just like to sit down the whole time.
Yeah.
And so Ironside, I would like to practice weapons by myself, self-defense without weapons for a while. So that's what Ironside was on. And then on February 28th, 1970, Simon and Garfunkel take over the Billboard chart. The really slow.
Like a bridge over. Is it right?
Trouble.
Yeah.
Water. You're right.
Yep. I love Simon and Garfunkel.
Now, this is all Art Garfunkel singing this, right?
Yeah. No, I think, I think they both sing on it. He sings a lot of it, though.
I think it's all Garfunkel.
When they sing, like, Sail on Silver Girls, Sail on By. But it's mostly Art Garfunkel.
This song gets me every time. Like, I get sort of like sad and emotional. It's a really good song.
I love their Greatest Hits album. I know that true fans don't like Greatest Hits albums as a rule, but
that's just a way for them to say they're better than you.
I know, but I think their Greatest Hits album is one of my favorite albums.
Well, Paul Simon saw Elvis in concert in 1970, and he saw him cover this song.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Simon said, "We might as well just give up."
Why?
Because it was so good.
Really?
He loved Elvis's cover of this so much that he was like, oh, shit.
Let's
just give up.
Nobody knows Elvis's version now. No. Nowadays.
I watch. It's on YouTube. You can watch
it. Right, but what I'm saying is the one that stuck was Simon and Garfunkel's version.
Oh, yeah. Their version was original. I mean, they wrote it, and Elvis covered them. But if I watch it on YouTube, I don't think it's that great.
Really?
Because it just sounds like Elvis. Like, it looks like the Honky Tonk Man from WWF. And he's real sweaty.
Yeah.
Like, he was rough towards
the end. Yeah, he was. He was real rough.
I'm not sure when he died, but we're going to have to cover it when he dies. But he was fat and sweaty. And it's just so cliche, though. I think Elvis impersonators have ruined Elvis.
Like, yeah.
I really think they have. Like, maybe old school Elvis was cool, but...
I do. I still like him, Elvis.
But this was bordering on fat Elvis.
Yeah.
So. I don't think it was that great. I think Paul Simon and
I can picture it. It's probably just like his in a ghetto, you know, like that kind of.
And he's wearing the white jumpsuit and everything. But anyway, they thought it was so good that they were never going to do it.
He still wore that awful jumpsuit and he real did. Fat.
Yeah,
fat. And he got his Plum Smuggler on. Yeah,
Plum Smuggler, that's right. Yep. Thursday, March 5th, 1970, the movie Airport was released.
Oh, my God. And this was hysterical.
Yeah, we watched...
Not meant to be.
Nah, yeah, it was supposed to be serious. But watching the trailer for this, you and I watched it, it's pretty obvious that Airplane, the movie,
that's
was
right.
a spoof of this.
Yeah.
Which I had never known or seen.
I didn't either. I mean, Airplane, the movie, we both know and we both love, but... It was pretty much frame for frame almost looked like Airport.
Yeah,
the movie Airport.
I was watching this when we watched this trailer. We saw many of the scenes. We're like, oh, that's what they were.
Yeah.
That's why they did
that. This lady got slapped on the plane.
The lady got slapped was hysterical. They're slapping in an airplane, the movie.
But this was supposed to be serious. It was like romance, adventure, in the sky. It was like Jekyll and Bessette, Burt Lancaster or whatever.
Burt Lancaster, Dean Martin, George Kennedy, Jekyll and Bessette. Yeah. It was actually based on actual events. Apparently, the first domestic terrorism and the bombing of Continental Airlines Flight Number 11 from O'Hare to Kansas City. But the film includes five Oscar winners: Burt Lancaster, Van Heflin, George Kennedy, Helen Hayes, and Maureen Stapleton, and one Oscar nominee, Quinn K. Rediger. I do want to see it, kind of, just to...
Yeah.
Just to see. The 70s were so different in movies.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
so there's some real great movies, and there's some really crap movies from the 70s.
Some of them are so iconic, and this is iconic for being shitty.
Yeah.
Like, everyone said, this was so shitty. It made a lot of money. It was the second highest grossing of the year.
But reviews were bad?
Yeah, reviews were terrible. They were saying it was shitty. And then on Tuesday, March 10th, 1970, on episode 87 of Sesame Street was the debut of a song that we all would grow to know and love, sung by Kermit the Frog.
Oh, It's Not Easy Being Green.
It's Not Easy Being Green.
I love that.
Yep. That was the first time that was ever
played. That's so cute.
Yep. That's such a good song, huh?
Yes, it is.
I didn't know that debuted on Sesame Street.
Yep. Well, Kermit was, that's where he was first, before the Muppet Show. He was on Sesame Street always.
Someday we'll find it. The Rainbow Connection.
That's not a bad impersonation.
It's not easy being green. That's only one. That's the only thing I can do.
Is Kermit the Frog.
Because I talked like Kermit the Frog and Ernie for like 4 years, 5 years of my life. Anyway, and then on Wednesday, March 11th, the very next day. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the very next day, Wednesday, March 11th, was the Grammy Awards, hosted by Andy Williams, your crush.
No.
Your celebrity crush.
No.
Andy Williams.
No.
Yeah, you've always had a thing.
No, I never had a thing for Andy Williams.
Do you know any songs he sings? You know what he's famous for? What's the big song he's famous for?
Is it Moon River or something?
Moon River.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know how that goes.
Moon River,
there you go.
Wider than a mile.
That sucks.
Crossing you in style someday.
Do you want to take a guess for album of the year in 1970? It was from the year before, 69. 69, dude.
Is it something from the Beatles?
Nope.
I don't know.
Aquarius.
Oh, Age of Aquarius.
Let the Sunshine. Yep, Aquarius / Let the Sunshine In was album of the year.
That's a great song, too.
Best new artist was Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Best new artist?
Best new artist.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
They were funny. New.
Yep. That was before Young joined them.
Yep. It was just Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Okay, now I need you to strap
on. I love them, too.
Crosby, Stills, Nash?
Yep, I love me some Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Really?
Yep.
I love your stuff. What are
you, stuff. My dad? Yeah, I am.
My dad loves Crosby, Stills, Nash. Well, I'm listening to some Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
You're going
to
start echoing.
My shirt off.
You reclined.
Care. I don't care. But I do need you to strap on your strap on because...
Oh, you got something for me?
I got a big story here.
Yes.
Saturday, March 14th, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of Dr. Robert J. White?
No.
On Saturday, March 14th, 1970, Dr. Robert J. White was able to completely swap the head of one monkey and put it on another monkey and have it remain alive for 9 days.
Ew.
Yep. It's the first successful head transplant.
Oh, my God. For 9 days? That's successful?
Yeah, well... 9 days, they put a head on another...
I mean, I know, that's moved, amazing.
It, like, moved its body and everything.
It's amazing. I'm just saying, it's not like, oh, now we can do these.
Two rhesus monkeys were sedated and laid out
Poor
on separate
things.
Tables inside the fourth floor laboratory and labeled with letters A and B. The heads of both were removed, and the head of A was attached to the body of B. Yeah, poor things. Can you imagine?
That's like, awful.
What a terrible thing. And it woke up and almost bit me, says Dr. White. It moved the muscles in its face. It blinked its eyes. It chewed on pencils. More important, it mimicked tests that it had been trained to perform before the operation, proving for the first time that consciousness, or the soul, as Dr. White believes, can be transplanted by removal of the brain. What they had performed, the doctors...
Wait a minute. Which monkey was trained?
What they had performed, the doctors realized, was not a head transplant at all, but a whole body transplant. The monkey that had survived was the A monkey. After all, the head.
So the head, the monkey whose head it was the one who was that, trained.
Who was trained.
And that, then they put that head on another body, and they still knew how to do the test.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Really?
Your body's a machine for the brain, says Dr. White. The brain is where consciousness is located.
Yeah.
While the head was kept alive by the circulation provided by the B monkey's body, the spinal cord had been severed at the neck, and so the new brain could not control the body itself. Nerve endings cannot be sutured like blood vessels. Machines were required to keep the monkey's lungs breathing and its heart beating. but the monkey could still hear, smell, taste, and eat and follow objects with its eyes. Ultimately, immune rejection caused the monkey to die after 9 days. Some of that came from Bizarropedia, which is a thing that I didn't know existed.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Thursday, April 2nd, 1970.
Yes.
The movie Patton.
Yeah.
Was released, starring George C. Scott.
Mm-hmm.
He played Patton in the 1970 classic, and he refused to show up to the Oscars and accept his award because he said, the whole thing is a goddamn meat parade. I don't want any part of it.
A meat parade? What kind of comment is that?
He believed that every dramatic performance is unique and cannot be compared.
Okay.
And did you know that soldiers who served under the real George S. Patton said that the general's voice was surprisingly high-pitched?
Oh.
And this can be heard in actual films and recordings of him. Patton himself said that he used profanity so liberally in order to compensate for this.
Because he had a high voice.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then Tuesday, April 7th, 1970, the 42nd Academy Awards were presented at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, California. And for the second year in a row, there was no official host. Awards were presented by 17 friends of Oscar. Bob Hope, John Wayne, Barbara Streisand, Fred Astaire, John Voight, Myrna Loyd, Clint Eastwood, Raquel Welch, Candace Bergen, James Earl Jones, Catherine Ross, Cliff Robertson, Ally McGraw, Barbara McNair, Elliot Gould, Claudia Cardinale, and Elizabeth Taylor. This was the first Academy Awards ceremony to be broadcast via satellite to an international audience, but only outside North America. Mexico and Brazil were the sole countries to broadcast the event live.
Why in the world is it necessary to have 17 people host a show?
I don't know.
That's stupid.
Whoa.
It's just dumb.
Midnight Cowboy became the first and so far the only X-rated film to win the Academy Award for Best Picture.
I knew that.
And that it was X-rated?
Yeah.
Midnight Cowboy?
Mm-hmm. That's the one I think of whenever I think of like these kind of old-timey X-rated movies.
Well, its X-rating has since been downgraded to R. The previous...
Why is it X-rated, does it say?
No, the previous year had seen the only G-rated film to win Best Picture, Carol Reed's Oliver.
Okay.
Also this year, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Set an Oscar record by receiving 9 nominations without one for Best Picture.
They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
You ever heard of that movie?
No. What a dumb title.
I didn't either, and my grandma didn't recall it either. I asked her about as I was doing research. From
your grandma might not be the best oracle of knowledge about these things.
Do you remember that movie? And she said, no, but I remember George Kiroff.
She starts talking about her neighbor.
From the east side of Toledo in 1929. Saturday, April 11th, 1970, The Beatles are the number one spot in the Billboard chart. That's the cool thing about going back.
Yeah. You
got good music. The fucking Beatles.
Yeah. The Beatles
you know
are
what
like
song?
Let It Be.
Let It Be.
Let It Be. Let It Be.
Let It Be. Let It Be.
That's a great
there
song.
There will be an answer. Let It Be. I will admit I still hear that Sesame Street song.
What?
Let Her Be. Let Her
Oh,
Be.
Oh, I never saw that.
Let Her Be. Let Her Be. I think it's Sesame Street where they're teaching kids to let her be.
Yeah, and they use that.
So clever.
Mm-hmm.
But I always kind of hear that. But that's a great song, too.
It is a really good song.
It just, like, tugs at your heartstrings.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be the Beatles' final single before Paul McCartney announced his departure from the band.
I thought John Lennon's the one who left.
No, Paul McCartney. Remember John Lennon had that song about, how can you sleep at night, you motherfucker? You killed the Beatles. That's Paul's fault. He announced he was going to leave the band.
I thought John did because of Yoko.
No, Paul McCartney did because of Yoko, probably. Mm-hmm. But both the Let It Be album and the U.S. single, The Long and Winding Road, were released after McCartney's announced departure from and the subsequent breakup of the group. McCartney said he had the idea of Let It Be after he had a dream about his mother during the tense period surrounding the sessions for the Beatles' The White Album in 1968. According to McCartney, the song's reference to Mother Mary was not biblical. The phrase at times has been used as a reference to the Virgin Mary. Nevertheless, McCartney explained that his mother, who died of cancer when he was 14, was the inspiration for the Mother Mary lyric. He later said, it was great to visit with her again. I felt very blessed to have that dream. So that got me writing Let It Be. He also said in a later interview about the dream that his mother had told him, "It will be all right, just let it be." When asked if the song referred to the Virgin Mary, McCartney has typically answered the question by assuring his fans that they can interpret the song however they like.
Hmm.
But his mother's name was Mary.
I see.
Let it be, let it be.
It was a good song.
Whisper words of wisdom. That is a good song. But, I don't know, every time I think of the Beatles, I think, they gotta be aliens, right? Like, how could anybody have that many unbelievable songs? Is it just because McCartney and Lennon together were both geniuses that happened to find each other?
I think George Harrison, too.
But Ringo is just a thug.
Ringo's just, yeah. Ringo's
not a piece of shit. Yeah, George Harrison. Yeah, but George Harrison sang, "Got my mind set on you."
Yeah, but
which
he
ruined his whole legacy.
Right. But he sang some really good Beatles songs.
But my theory, too, is if John Lennon would have lived, he would have made a bunch of crap like Paul McCartney has and George Harrison.
Well, he would have gone through the 80s just like everybody else. And the 80s made everybody shitty.
That's true.
The 80s made everybody shitty. Every one of us.
The 80s making people shitty.
Yeah, it
was. Not George Michael.
No, his, well, it's, he didn't get good till 89.
That was in the 80s.
I know, but that's almost 90s.
That was in the 80s. What about Bon fucking Jovi? They were great in the 80s.
Yeah.
Hair bands were great.
That's true.
Motley Crue?
Yeah, I guess some of those were pretty good.
Oh, you love Motley Crue, Bo. Saturday. I already said Saturday. The Beatles. This is so cool. We're talking about the Beatles. They were great.
Yep.
Tuesday, April 14th, just a few days after the Beatles' Let It Be started just being inundated in everyone's radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
Just started being everywhere. The last episode of the Debbie Reynolds Show, starring Tom Bosley, was aired.
Starring Tom Bosley? I mean, know who he was, don't you?
Let's just be honest.
He was a Charlie's Angel.
Tom Bosley?
Oh, no. Bosley was, never mind. Bosley was the name of the character in Charlie's Angels. God. Tom Bosley was on Happy Days.
I could fill a room with your wrongness right now. Tom Bosley was a father motherfucking Dowling.
And Happy
he
Days.
Was the dad on Happy Days. Two of the greatest roles in American history.
You watched Father Dowling? I never watched that.
No, but it was probably great. Father motherfucking Dowling,
up.
Bitch.
Making some shit up over there.
A little known fact, Father Dowling was the inspiration for the rapper Father MC. Mm-hmm. That's where he got his name from, Father Dowling Mysteries.
Right.
Maybe. No, but anyway, Father Dowling, Tom Bosley was the fucking star of the Debbie Reynolds Show. Do you remember that? Do you know anything about the Debbie Reynolds
Show? No.
Anyway, the series only lasted one season because NBC was selling ad time to cigarette commercials against Debbie Reynolds' wishes.
Oh.
Because she signed a 2-year contract with NBC and owned half of the program, she was unable to be fired, so she walked away from the show instead.
I think that they must be pretty soon nearing the part where the cigarette commercials became illegal. I think
we'll probably get to that, but Debbie Reynolds once called this the stupidest mistake of her entire career, but she lost $2 million of income for quitting the show.
And at that time, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, that was a lot. On Thursday, April 16th, 1970, Greg the Hammer Valentine made his debut in professional wrestling.
No.
And Gorilla Monsoon defeated Karl Kovacs via disqualification in the Civic Arena in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
No, really? No.
Yeah. Wrestling, yeah. Wrestling.
No, you're adding some shit in.
No, there was wrestlers in 1970.
There
they
was?
Just weren't mainstream. Greg the Hammer Valentine's an old fucker.
He's that old?
But I bring this up because you have, meanwhile, while Greg the Hammer
Valentine's meanwhile, they
Gorilla Monsoon's defeating Karl Kovacs. It's back
they
to
finally,
your story.
Yep, they finally interrogated Dr. McDonald on April 16th, 1970.
The police interrogated him?
Yep, that was all.
While Greg the Hammer Valentine was making his debut
I guess
in wrestling?
So, yeah.
And while Gorilla Monsoon was defeating Karl Kovacs?
Yep.
Via DQ? And then Wednesday, April 22nd, 1970, Ross Perot became the biggest individual loser ever on the New York Stock Exchange.
Did he?
He lost $450 million in a single day.
Whoa.
Can't finish. Can't finish.
Yep.
And then later, they wrote that song about him, that Feliz Navidad.
What?
Feliz Navidad, Ross Perot.
That does not say Ross Perot in that song. No, they don't.
Feliz Navidad, Ross Perot lost $450 million in a single day. I think that's the rest.
No.
And then Saturday, April 25th, 1970, the Jackson 5 are back on top of the Billboard charts with
ABC.
Yep.
Easy as 1, 2, 3.
Now this song, honey, in 1970, is considered by some to be one of the first disco songs.
Oh, boom.
Do you consider this disco?
I would say no.
Oh, so those some
would be in opposition to me.
You're saying those some can go shove it up their ass.
No, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I just think.
Tell them to shove it up their ass.
I just think it's too Motown to be disco.
Excuse me, listeners who think this is one of the first disco songs, shove it up your ass. Stop listening to our podcast.
No, you're not welcome. No. Everybody has their own opinion.
Okay. Sunday, April 26th, the day after Jackson 5 take over the Billboard charts, the Dallas Morning News reported that a bomb consisting of 20 to 30 sticks of dynamite was detonated in the Senate chamber.
Oh, man.
The bomb was an apparent retaliation for the shootings of three African Americans by the police. A second bomb exploded at a Baton Rouge country club.
Mm-hmm.
A pencil remains to this day embedded in the ceiling of the chamber from the force of the explosion.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And that was because of three African Americans being shot by police.
And so somebody was pissed about that?
Yeah. In 1970.
Wow.
Some things never change.
That's right. On May 1st, Dr. McDonald was formally charged with murder.
He was charged with murder. So they, yes, after they interrogated him, now they haven't found anybody else. They think he did it.
He formally charged him with murder, yeah.
Dr. McDonald. And then Saturday, May 2nd, the very next day after that happened,
mm-hmm,
well, at first the Kentucky Derby winner was Dust Commander.
Okay. Thank you for not making me guess.
But after serving 20 years as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi,
mm-hmm,
get your outrage hat on because you're going to be mad.
Okay.
Alan Cavett Thompson retired in 1969, and he formed Focus, a group that he touted as a supporter of the freedom of choice in America. Using that freedom of choice, Thompson's organization protested taxpayer dollars being spent to air Sesame Street.
Assholes.
In response to the outcry, a state commission was formed in April 1970 to address whether Sesame Street should be permitted to be broadcast on public television. The five-person panel eventually ruled that the children's show should be banned.
Oh.
One of the members of the commission, likely upset by the decision, leaked the results to the New York Times.
Good for them.
In which it became a major news story. A commission member, speaking anonymously, stated that some of the members of the commission were very much opposed to showing the series because it used a highly integrated cast of children.
Oh.
And furthermore, that the main objection was mainly that we're not ready for it yet in Alabama.
Oh my God, how backwards.
22 days after its original decision, the commission reversed itself, and Sesame Street was approved in Mississippi, where it has remained ever since. However, for 22 days, the show was indeed banned by Mississippi.
Oh, makes me sick.
Isn't that weird?
Backward fucks.
Just because of somebody's color.
Yeah. It is awful.
What a weird world we live in. I mean, we were founded on slavery, so why are we surprised?
That's true.
And then 2 days later, four Kent State University students were shot and killed.
Four dead in Ohio.
By the Ohio National Guard during the Vietnam War protest. Yep. So we all know about the Kent State shootings.
Mm-hmm.
Four dead in Ohio. That was by
Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, your favorite group.
Yeah.
But did you know that in 2014, Urban Outfitters tried to sell a vintage, bloody-looking Kent State sweatshirt on their website? Yeah.
Oh.
Isn't that weird?
That's awful.
Did you know that Devo bassist and singer Gerald Cassell witnessed the Kent State shootings?
No, I did not.
That day, he stopped being a hippie and focused on their concept of de-evolution, that mankind had begun to regress. That's where Devo came from.
Oh, de-evolution.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
And Devo started that early, huh? I always think of them as an 80s band.
Well, it must have taken them a long time to get
that. That's true.
You must whip it. They probably were like a really good, smart, intelligent band for years, and then all of a sudden they're like, now let's put these red tops on our heads and sing Whip It.
That's right.
Whip It Good. And then Friday, May 8th, 1970, the Eastern Division champion New York Knicks defeated the Western Division champion Los Angeles Lakers in a best-of-seven series, 4-3 for their first NBA title. The MVP was Willis Reed.
I don't care about any of that.
May 9th, 1970, the Guess Who take over the Billboard charts. Do you know the band, the Guess Who?
Yeah. I can't think of the song.
You can think of any songs by the Guess Who? Because I don't know anything else they did.
What is it?
Except this.
What is it?
American Woman.
Oh, yeah. Stay away from me.
Stay away from me.
It's a good
me.
Song.
Do you know that they're Canadian?
Mm-mm.
And this song's origins took the form of a live jam that emerged during a curling rink concert in southern Ontario.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, they said it was a popular place for bands to play. But when Bachman was the name of the guy in the band that wrote it, he broke a string. He unknowingly played the riff to American Woman when tuning the replacement string. He played it louder and louder. And Cummings improvised the lyrics to fit what Bachman was playing, and they noticed some kid had a cassette recorder, mm-hmm. making a bootleg recording, and they asked him for the tape because they wanted to figure out, hey, we want to record that.
Oh.
And that became the studio recording. May 30th, 1970, Ray Stevens, Everything is Beautiful. Thanks
Ray
over the
Stevens.
Ray Stevens on the top of the Billboard. I've never heard of Ray Stevens in my life.
He sings that, they call me the Streak. He would always have those infomercials for Ray Stevens albums. You know how they used to have infomercials of like people for people's album?
Yeah.
And he would always have one, and it had all these cartoons that would go through it. And there's one song he sings about the Streak, and it's some naked old man cartoon of this naked old man running.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but this is a country song, and it's like
everything
it starts out,
is beautiful in its own way.
Now, Friday, June 12th, 1970. Self-reportedly under the influence of LSD, Doc Ellis of the Pittsburgh Pirates threw a no-hitter against the San Diego Padres to win 2-0 on Friday, June 12th, in the first game of a twilight doubleheader at San Diego Stadium. The Pirates flew to San Diego on Thursday, June 11th, for a series against the Padres.
Mm-hmm.
Ellis reported that he visited a friend in Los Angeles and used LSD 2 or 3 times. Thinking it was still Thursday, he took a hit of LSD on Friday at noon.
Boom.
And his friend's girlfriend reminded him at 2 p.m., oh, man, dog, you're scheduled to pitch tonight. Ellis flew.
Shit.
I don't know why she said dog. Ellis flew from Los Angeles to San Diego at 3 p.m. and arrived at San Diego Stadium at 4:30 p.m. The game started at 6:05 p.m. Ellis threw the no-hitter despite being unable to feel the ball or see the batter or catcher clearly.
Oh, my God.
Ellis said his catcher, Jerry May, wore reflective tape on his fingers, which helped him to see May's signals. Ellis walked.
So the catcher must have known that he was on LSD.
He must have told him. Yo, man, I'm really fucking high right now.
You're tripping.
Ellis walked 8 batters and struck out 6.
Oh, my God.
And he was aided by excellent fielding plays from second baseman Bill Mazeroski and center fielder Matty Alou.
A no-hitter.
Matty Alou. Does Alou sound familiar?
Yeah.
Moises Alou. Remember for the Cubs? That's his uncle.
Okay.
And as Ellis recounted, I can only remember bits and pieces of the game. I was psyched. I had a feeling of euphoria. I was zeroed in on the catcher's glove, but I didn't hit the glove too much. I remember hitting a couple of batters, and the bases were loaded 2 or 3 times.
Oh my gosh.
The ball was small sometimes. The ball was large sometimes. Sometimes I saw the catcher. Sometimes I didn't.
Holy shit.
Sometimes I tried to stare the hitter down the throw while I was looking at him. I chewed my gum until it turned to powder. I started having a crazy idea in the fourth inning that Richard Nixon was the home plate umpire. And once I thought I was pitching a baseball to Jimi Hendrix, who to me was holding a guitar and swinging it over the plate. They say I had about 3 to 4 fielding chances. I remember diving out of the way of a ball I thought was a line drive. I jumped, but the ball wasn't hit hard and never reached me. Ellis reported that he never used LSD during the season again, though he continued to use amphetamines. After the story was made public, he said he regretted taking LSD that day because it robbed him of his greatest professional memory.
But I wonder, would he have been able to do it without the LSD?
A no-hitter.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
You know what a no-hitter is?
Yeah.
Like, nobody gonna hit.
I mean,
don't
you think it must have been the LSD that did that?
No. He was probably pretty good. No. It's amazing that he can do it with the LSD.
But did he ever do it without?
Oh, I'm sure he did. I don't know. No, I'm not sure he did.
No.
I don't know anything.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe it was the LSD that... Something about being on that.
No, because then he would fucking do it all the time and so would everybody else.
But maybe it was just something weird with him.
He thought he was pitching to fucking Jimi Hendrix. I know. He didn't see
That's
anything.
Insane.
No idea what was going on. But what I think it is though, it's all just mechanics. It's just like
you're
a pitcher and you become, you know, learning the mechanics. But holy shit.
Can you imagine trying to do that?
I don't think I could do anything on LSD.
No,
I have no idea what it's like. I've
never
taken
either.
It.
Yeah.
I've been scared to death of taking it, but I have a friend who took it once. with some other friends that were taking. He had a what they call a bad trip that he was just freaking out the whole fucking time. And I had to take, we had to all take care of him.
Oh, really?
Because he was like, oh, the government's out to get me. You guys are spies. And June 13th, 1970, the Beatles.
Yeah.
The Long and Winding Road took over the Billboard's top chart.
It's one of my less favorite Beatles songs.
I listen to it. It's not good. Yeah. I don't like it.
I know the song. I just, it's not one of my favorites.
And I will say this probably was only up there because it was the Beatles. And they were going away and they're like, oh, well, that's a Beatles song. Better put it in the number one
spot. It could be.
No, it sucks. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, Beatles fans. That song sucks. The Long and Winding Road is not a good song.
Yeah. It's like they took a poem and decided to make it into a song, like it was a poem first or something.
Well, something that might have added to its suckiness is that Phil Spector took the song and added orchestral and choral overdubs.
That's a big part of it that makes it so bad.
Yeah, and his modifications pissed off Paul McCartney to the point that when he made his case to the British High Court for the Beatles' dissolution, he cited the treatment of The Long and Winding Road as one of his six reasons for breaking up the
Beatles. He had to go to a high court,
I guess,
to disband the Beatles.
I don't know.
Why couldn't they just break up like everybody else?
I don't know. Apparently, he had to do that because they're so good. I don't know. I didn't do the research. Maybe I should.
Yeah.
And report back next week. But
yeah, you should.
But he said Phil Spector fucking with that. Phil Spector with giant fucking hair.
That's bizarre.
Saturday, June 27, 1970, the Jackson 5 take over the Billboard chart and knock the Beatles right off.
Okay.
They're only from the 13th to 26th. The Love You Save might be your own. Marlon and Tito are the greatest Jacksons of all time.
Marlon and Tito.
This features the side vocals of Jermaine Jackson singing alongside Michael in the final Stop the Love You Say.
Jermaine Jackson had his own music, didn't he, in the 80s?
It wasn't good.
No, I know.
Besides Marlon. Right.
But I don't think Marlon and Tito ever did anything on their own.
The opening exclamation stop and the foot stomps that complement the rhythm during the latter part of the song are allusions to the 1965 number one.
So who were the five? It was Marlon, Tito, Michael Jermaine.
Michael Jermaine, Marlon, Tito.
Who's the fifth one?
Randy.
Okay. Is that right?
Wait. Not the Randy Jackson that's from...
No.
There was a Randy, though. But it's an allusion to the 1965 number one Motown single by the Supremes, Stop in the Name of Love. So it's going to be sort of a...
Homage. You almost called it an homage.
Homage.
All right, and that brings us to the end of...
We're going to leave the first episode of 1970 on the motherfucking Jackson 5 because they're great.
And thank you for listening. And be sure to check us out on Twitter at History for Jerks.
And thank you to the Queen City Podcast Network.
Yes.
Shout out. What up? We're in a network, y'all.
All right.
We're in a network.
And it is time to get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry, we're in a network, you motherfucker. Get out of the bathroom.
All right. Take it easy.
I love you.
Take it away, Matt Truman.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.